in terms of this divide between invulnerability and hopelessness. Mm-hmm. And so I look at the concentration of wealth and the invulnerability that those at the top feel as being highly vulnerable to social outrage. And I don't pretend to know how that social outrage manifests. And it's not a political left versus right. I think that the all of the attention left versus right is missing the bigger point. It's up down where the big problem is. And there are far more at the bottom these days than there are at the top.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. While we often focus on the hard numbers and data when analyzing the economy and financial markets, we have to remember that these systems are ultimately driven by humans, which means price behavior is a function of factors like sentiment and confidence. Today, we're fortunate to speak with Peter Atwater, adjunct professor of economics at William & Mary College. Peter is a top expert in how changes in confidence consistently and predictably impact investor preferences, decisions, and actions. We'll ask him what his key confidence indicators are telling him about the prospects for 2023. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Adam. Glad to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure. I appreciate you making time at the end of the year, in between the end of classes and the winter holidays, to speak with us. I know the last time you were on, you had the very good fortune of being interviewed by Stephanie Pomboy on this channel. I'm sorry to say you're going to have to suffer through it with me as the questioner here. I apologize also for my voice. Hopefully it's getting better here. But I'm very excited to talk with you, Peter. I have a lot of respect for the human side of the equation that you bring into all the numbers that we normally talk with on this channel. So looking forward to rolling up my sleeves and getting into those with you. Just to kick things off here, a general question, it's really just to kind of set the context here, but what is your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
So in terms of the economy, I think that we have been through a remarkable boom since COVID hit. There was, you know, extraordinary, unprecedented, whatever the adjective you want to use, amounts of money thrown into the system. And you saw the crowd respond accordingly. And now I think we're seeing the other side of that big bullwhip effect as prices begin to collapse on the other side. And what's fascinating to me is to watch the markets try to anticipate what's ahead. And I think that when I look at the markets right now, I see a big divergence of opinion between the inflationistas and the deflationistas. So it's an interesting moment to watch.
Very interesting. And I imagine you've got to be interested by the divergence of opinion between just the market participants that have been sort of trained in Pavlovian style to buy the dip, just go along everything. And up until now, don't fight the Fed. But now, you know, Jerome Powell is doing everything he can to try to talk the market down, and the market is just trying its best not to listen to him.
Yeah, I think, although what's interesting is you then look at bond investor positioning, and they clearly think that there's a world of hurt out there to come in terms of inflation. So it's a really striking contrast between what's being said and what's being experienced by investors.
All right. And I hear you coughing, and this is maybe going to be the duel of the sicknesses here. Hopefully we can both soldier through this. All right. Well, look, I want to get into a bunch of questions I have for you. Before we do, though, just to sort of ground everybody, can you provide a refresher on your confidence-based framework for analyzing financial, economic, political, and social trends? In particular, I'm curious, like, does this fall under the behavioral economics umbrella?
Technically, I think it does, but I would argue that my brethren in the world of behavioral economics tend to focus on the exceptions in our behavior, you know, where we make mistakes, where we let biases, you know, undermine our decision-making. I don't care about any of that. My focus is on the choices we make day in and day out. And there it's, you know, more behavioral finance, but just behavior, broadly speaking, I've come to think that maybe I'm more of an anthropologist than I am an economist, just watching sort of cultures behave. And investors, I think, are an interesting culture. My framework is pretty simple. I care about confidence. And when I talk about confidence, I don't mean the theatrics of confidence that seem to be everywhere these days. I care about our feelings of certainty and our feelings of control. We need both of those to feel confident. So I'm looking for displays of where people feel invincible at one end of the spectrum and where they feel vulnerable, intensely vulnerable, hopeless at the other. We don't think of it in these terms, but vulnerability is the opposite of confidence. And vulnerability is a really great way to look at the behavior of investors, because at lows, when they're capitulating, they're conceding their vulnerability, and at tops, they're feeling invulnerable, like nothing is ever going to hurt them. The last thing, and I think this is where it gets really fun, is that there is equilibrium that exists between our level of confidence, our actions, and the stories we tell. And you might guess that I don't care about facts, I don't care about data. All I care about are the stories, and stories we tell, stories we post on Twitter, and even more so the stories that get picked up by the media, because they are the ultimate storytellers, and they tell stories about the stories we tell. So that's how I look at the world.
That's fascinating. Kind of the way I'm thinking about this, and correct me if I'm wrong. So I would say the average person says or assumes, hey, we make really rational decisions around money and around markets because it's all so quantifiable. And I think the behavioral economists would say, no, we make very irrational decisions because we're human animals and we have a lot of evolutionary wiring that plays against artists, often in ways that are subconscious for us, right? And I think you would say, well, actually, we make decisions based upon the stories we tell ourselves, and those stories may be accurate or they may not be accurate, but you got to understand the story to understand the decision.
Yeah, I'd say we make rationalized decisions. You know, we can let people decide in hindsight whether they were good or bad, but we always have a story to go along with what we do, and we may express it, but we are driven by story, and story moves far faster and easier than fact.
That's a great way to put it. Conventional wisdom is we make rational decisions. Behavioral economists say we make irrational decisions. And your study says we make rationalized decisions. Okay, great. But again, to understand the decision-making in that world, you have to understand the stories, because that's total sense to me. Well, what are the big trends in confidence and vulnerability that have your attention most right now?
So there are a couple. One is clearly the vulnerability around energy and energy supply. So you're seeing a lot of very impulsive emotional reaction as a result of the war in Ukraine. And so it's been fascinating to watch as policymakers and the private sector begin to think about how do you address the national vulnerabilities, the localized vulnerabilities that exist. That's one that I think we are going to see dramatic changes as people respond to those feelings of scarcity, particularly in Europe. I'm also fascinated by the vulnerability around the supply chain and the way we've responded, which is a pretty classic response to vulnerability, which is, I don't like things that are important to me to be far away from me. And so I want them closer. So I'm going to hoard, I'm going to source things more locally. And I think that that's a trend that is likely to continue so long as underlying sentiment remains weak, you know, and sort of a broad measure of mood. At the same time, I am fascinated by the invincibility that I see among those at the very top, who continue to just go along as if nothing has happened. And so the extraordinary concentration of wealth in the hands of very few have left a population around the world who are seemingly feel like they're immune to any of the market's ups and downs, that there will always be money, that sense of permanence that exists for those at the top, that you're seeing very fanciful futuristic ideas out there, and those are global among the financial elite.
All right, those are all fascinating, and I think areas I'd like to dig into you on each of them. I'm curious with the energy vulnerability. Obviously, the energy trade lines that got completely discombobulated by the Russian invasion of Ukraine, totally get that part. I believe one could also say, and I'm curious if you would agree, that the whole ESG movement is full of narratives. And I'm not going to pick which ones are right or which ones are wrong, but certainly, there's a massive inflow of capital into the ESG space and has been long preceding the war in Ukraine. And, I would say that there's, strong voices on both sides, right? Some say we have to do it both for sort of national security and for saving the planet and all that stuff. And then other sides who are saying, boy, the approach that we're taking is naive. It's creating bigger problems for us, even if we have the same goals in the long run. And then there's also other voices saying, hey, it's a manufactured crisis. It's really, the threat's not really as bad as we see. So would you put ESG in that same vulnerability category for energy?
So I look at the ESG space as being a symptom of extreme confidence, that the time horizon, as you mentioned, to a lot of the ESG content is very long term. The whole concept is highly abstract. And it's very reminiscent of the "we need to tackle the environment" movement that you saw at the peaks of confidence in the 1960s, when environmentalism really came to the fore. And this is something that is not uncommon at extremes in confidence, where we choose these audacious, generous, very very weighty objectives to tackle. And what I think is more likely to be the case is that if people feel vulnerable, we're going to care far less about ESG than we are going to be about the environmental realities that exist today. So rather than focusing on long-term projects, we're going to be responding impulsively and emotionally to where disasters occur, whether it's in environmental issues, issues of government, or certainly market regulation. So I think we need to stop looking out on the horizon and move our lens much closer to the immediate, with the understanding that if confidence is low, we're gonna stop thinking strategically, and people will demand that action be taken to solve the real tactical problems that exist that are compounding our vulnerability in real time.
All right, that's super interesting and understandable. I was sort of looking at ESG as a vulnerability of, hey, we're worried about the damage to the planet and are dependent on fossil fuels and stuff like that. But you're saying it's really more of a symptom of overconfidence, that we can cure all that quickly. And what I hear you saying is let's use Germany as a case study here, right? Very confident they could make the transition. They decommissioned their nuclear fleet, made a bunch of investments in renewables, and ended up getting caught flat-footed by the dynamics that the Russian invasion of Ukraine created. And you're basically saying that once that confidence that they can get it done quickly shifts to vulnerability of more short-term threats, a lot of those noble goals of the future kind of get deprioritized, go out the window, and it's, we just got to do whatever we got to do to meet our immediate term needs. You're nodding as I'm saying this.
Exactly. Exactly. The time, there's a collapse in the time frame. And ESG will become a victim of that, to the extent that you see real threats in the areas that ESG now covers.
Okay. I want to get into the invincibility of the wealthy elites that you talked about earlier, because the wealth gap is something that's a big concern of mine, and I've talked about it a lot in this program in the past. And I want to talk about the K-shaped recovery in particular, because it's exacerbated that, and that's also a term that you coined. Before we do, though, I want to stay on this topic of confidence and vulnerability, because there's a really big showdown going on right now. I kind of nodded to it a little bit earlier. Jerome Powell is planting a deep flag saying, I am going to do whatever it takes to bring inflation down, right? And he is projecting confidence that, doing his best to project confidence that Fed's got it under control, folks. And yes, it's going to be painful, but I'm going to get this done. Believe me, double down, double serious, believe me here. And I'm going to raise rates above 5. I'm not going to pivot. I'm going to hold rates high for a long period of time. And then we'll see what's going to happen. But our goal is to get inflation under control. And there's a lot of people that are saying, I just don't think he's going to be able to do that because something's going to break. And where I'm going with this is if indeed something breaks, especially if it's bad enough to force the Fed to pivot, do we enter kind of a new world where whatever our plans were prior to that period, they go out the window because now we're just trying to keep the system from imploding?
Yeah. So I think, again, let's talk about vulnerability. If you think about the history of the Fed, the point at which it was most vulnerable was the late 1970s. Confidence in the Fed collapsed. And I like to say, and you know, push back if you want, I think confidence in the Fed and central banks more broadly is measured in interest rates. And so yep. When was it worst? When was there no confidence in the Fed? You know, 1980 sometime. When was confidence so extreme in the Fed that and other central banks that people were willing to buy negative interest rate yielding bonds? You know, much more recently.
Right.
And so you can see that since that peak in bond prices in early 2021, we've seen this beginning of questioning of the Fed. I actually think the Fed is almost destined to overreact, to kill the inflation threat because it suffers from trauma. They remember 1980. And one of the things I know is that when we experience trauma, we never want to go back. And so we overcompensate for the traumas that we've experienced in our life by trying to be more certain, more in control, to sort of put up barbed wire fence so that we don't go back. And if you're in the Fed, that barbed wire fence is raising short-term interest rates to kill the ghost of inflation past.
Right. And sorry to interrupt, but as they say, the generals are always fighting the last war.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And this is a clear example because the generals got badly bloodied in that last war. So I think what we're seeing is the Fed is going to, if it has not already, overcompensated in hiking rates. And so it's going to be less of a pivot than it is going to be a dramatic retreat. Because I believe that inflation was highly transitory in this most recent couple of years. Why? Because we have a marked-to-market economy. We don't make major purchases today without checking the market price on them. And this is a really important element linking sentiment and market prices tighter than ever before. And you could really see this with gas prices and the connection between the crude market, prices at the pump, and consumer sentiment. And so I think that what's happened is we as consumers overreacted much the same way market participants overreact in these violent swings in markets. And so I believe that we experienced a major peak in inflation, probably around June, when everybody said that gas prices could only go higher. And now we're on the other side of it. And so I'm expecting that as inflation figures start to come down sharply, the Fed is going to have no choice but to scramble in the other direction. And I think bond investors at the moment are woefully ill-positioned for that. The statistics on, you know, the volume of bond investors being short here is dramatic. And I think that what we're likely to see is a massive short covering rally in bonds.
Okay. So this is great territory to really roll up our sleeves and dig into. So it sounds like you feel like the Fed indeed is going to break something, and then they're going to be forced to dramatically retreat, not pivot with poise, but you know, aggressively retreat, which I believe means you think they will bring rates down again, probably substantially, and they will stop tightening and probably go back to easing at some point in here. So from a standpoint of the person watching this video who's trying to get a sense for where the puck is coming from, and I'll preface all this by saying, Peter, nobody is a crystal ball. We're talking probabilities. Nobody's going to hold you to this exactly. But that up until that time, we can probably expect more of the same of what we've seen this year, right? Where economic growth is going to continue to contract. That asset prices are likely to probably not do very well up until such time as there is a big pivot. When the pivot happens, certain asset classes will probably react really quickly to that news, bonds being a good example. My guess is, I've heard other people say as well, precious metals will probably react well to that as well. Stocks, and I know that you're less of a stock analyst, but stocks would recover in that type of environment and may do quite well depending upon the size of the policy reversal. But in past pivots, they've usually lagged in their recovery by a quarter or two because you have all the rippling effects of the previous rate hikes that are going through the system and whatnot. So you're nodding as I'm saying this. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I'm just trying to see, is this sort of the picture that you're painting here for us?
Yeah, the bond position is really clear to me because the sentiment data, the positioning are all in alignment to suggest that folks are way off sides, that you know, the crowd believes heavily that inflation is the problem and that inflation is likely to not be the problem. So the bond rally is, I think, especially likely. In fact, I'd go so far, Adam, as to say we could, and this is going to sound crazy, we could see negative rates again if the scramble to, you know, to catch up is as extreme as the scramble was to on the other side. You could see this highly impulsive yo-yo behavior among central banks and investors.
Okay, and sorry to interrupt, but just to be clear, you're talking about negative nominal rates again.
Negative nominal rates.
Right, and I'm just going to ask, because someone's going to ask in the comments, we saw those outside of the U.S. Do you see any chance of those occurring in the U.S., given the size of the scramble that the Fed you perceive is going to have to do?
Yeah, I think if you saw a scramble because of the Fed, if you saw collateral shortages, where investors are in desperate need of AAA U.S. government bonds for some exogenous reason, you could see negative rates again. It's a wild, I know it sounds ridiculous now, but I think it speaks to the level of sentiment overload that I sense in the bond market. And I sort of view markets as swinging pendulums, where when we overreact to one side, we overreact again on the other.
Okay. And sorry to interrupt you one more time, but just because this is such an important point. There have been a couple of investors that I have interviewed recently on this program who share your point of view here, Peter. And more than one of them have said, this may be the most attractive environment that I've seen for bonds in my lifetime in terms of upside. Both with the ability to kind of get paid to wait right now, because they're actually paying, you know, more than I have in years. But you have that kind of call option upside in case what you're saying happens. And it could be dramatic. I mean, if we go back to the point where there are negative rates, around the world about this, whatever the Fed rate is, it's going to be a lot lower than it is right now. So the upside, especially in the long end of the curve, could be really dramatic here.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, all right. So I'm just going to remind people, you know, we've been talking a lot about bonds on this program. If you don't feel like you fully understand them, we have a free webinar that the folks at Real Investment Advice gave on this channel a couple of weeks back. If you want to watch that, just go to wealthion.com/bonds and you can watch that for free. But, you know, if what Peter is saying is compelling to you and you don't quite feel yet that you understand bonds well enough, go watch that. All right, Peter. So that's bonds. Stocks, you've said, I don't know if I let you go into that territory quite yet, but I think you said you see the bond opportunity really clearly. Stocks a little grayer for you?
Yeah. So to your point, the question with stocks, I think, boils down to the story. So if bonds start to rally in price, the bond market is going to need a story. And so the story there is going to be really important. Because if it's a story of economic slowdown, then you could see equities punished. You could see the classic response where bonds do well when stocks don't, which is something we didn't see in the past 2 years, right?
Right.
You know, the past 2 years, they've been tracking one
on top of it.
So we could see a breakdown in that correlation, which would be another case where people are caught off sides. The other side is the one that you mentioned, which is rates start to come down and the crowd says, we're off to the races. And there you could see almost a hyperinflationary kind of move in stock prices, particularly if you start to see dollar weakness. Because if you look at earnings estimates for next year, a lot of them have been hammered because of expectations of a strong dollar. And so if you saw a weak dollar helps multinational corporate earnings, then suddenly you've got a reason to get even more enthusiastic about stocks. So I'm in a point right now with the equity market where I need to see a story develop. You know, in June, in the fall, it was a bubble and gloom. I mean, I've not seen so much disaster porn in my life. Everybody was, you know, they all but had seats set up at the edge of the cliff so that they could watch. And this rally since, I haven't seen much of a improvement in sentiment. So I think that I'd like to see some kind of improvement in equity sentiment before getting really bearish again.
Got it. Okay. wait, getting really bearish again or getting really bullish again?
I'd like, if I'm going to get bearish, my precondition to bearishness is everybody being bullish, and nobody is bullish in equities right now.
Okay. Got it. Okay. This is a bit of a fundamentals question, but I will get back to sentiment in a second. If the Fed pivots, right? I think the bullish sentiment there is, hey, then we go back to the script that we had from 2009 to 2021. Right, where the Fed's just pumping liquidity into the world and easing, bringing rates down. And yeah, maybe that doesn't find its way into the real economy, but it goes back into financial asset prices, right? So it's sort of a bullish story on financial assets. Some people would say, well, if the Fed pivots before it's got inflation under control, well, then inflation is just going to come roaring back. You know, there could be some debate on that. I think understandably, some people say, yeah, it should. And other people might say, well, but you know, if we don't have the fiscal stimulus side of things, and if the stimulus that we, you know, pumped into the directly into the system from the pandemic is pretty much gone at that point, and the supply chains have healed enough, then yeah, maybe it'll be like the past 10 years where prior to the COVID, where, you know, the monetary stimulus didn't really go out into the real world. Do you have an opinion one way or the other on that?
Yeah, so I have a general view of the Fed that they are not the leading behavior that everybody expects them to be. This is a bureaucratic government organization. When have you ever seen a bureaucratic government organization lead a crowd? The crowd always moves first. The Fed is in the business of responding and reacting to the crowd. And so I look at the crowd story to say, what does it believe? Because the crowd is going to change their story before the Fed acts on that story. So that the sequence is the crowd narrative changes, the Fed acts in response.
Got it.
And so,
which I think history bears out.
Yeah. And so until the crowd story changes from I'm afraid of inflation, the Fed is going to double down on it. But when the crowd changes, and the crowd, you and I both know, the crowd can change its opinion overnight. You know, one CPI number and inflation could be viewed as a thing of the past. And so I think that we need to expect that the markets will move and then the Fed will follow in its response.
Okay. Although it is interesting to that, so I totally agree. We had a little preview of that with the last CPI release, right? Where the markets just partied incredibly disproportionately to the small decrease in CPI. And in many ways, I think that frustrates the Fed because the Fed is trying to tighten and that's easing the fiscal situation when the markets react like that. But I understand what you're saying. And let me explain it, put it in different words and you can correct it, which is I can see a possibility, but I would say almost a probability next year that the economy continues to slow and corporate margins continue to compress. And we enter like a recession that nobody argues about, right? It's not, we're not arguing about the definition of recession. We can all feel it. And we're like, all right, this feels like a recession. And then we begin to get real layoffs. I mean, we're already seeing, you know, the building of hiring freezes, and certainly in tech and other industries, we're seeing, you know, the first round of decent sized layoffs. But we could get to a point where we really begin to shed jobs, you know, in a serious way. And if that's coincident with something breaking in the system, you know, I guess you could see the herd tell the Fed, hey, I don't care about inflation as much today. Like I'm drowning. I've lost my job. Prospects look awful. You got to step in here. And that's how the Fed's going to follow?
Yeah. So again, the shift in time preference. Inflation is a big long-term threat. If I don't have a job, I care about the economy right now. So I think the Fed would be forced into a position of caring about the immediate shape of the economy, inflation be damned.
Okay. And is the Fed going to be the main water carrier again for this? Meaning, because we now have a divided Congress, is the likelihood of fiscal stimulus materially lower? You're kind of in the DC area, so I presume you've got a finger closer to that pulse than I do out here in California. I would presume that up until a certain pain threshold, the Republicans will probably do everything they can to thwart, you know, the administration, just because DC is so bipartisan not bipartisan these days, so partisan these days. Do you agree that it would resist and resist, and the Fed would have to do all the heavy lifting until potentially things got super bad, and then, all right, you know, politicians are going to do what politicians do.
Yeah, between now and the election in 24, there's no interest in big fiscal stimulus on either side of the aisle. You know, Democrats don't want to be seen being, you know, spending money unnecessarily, particularly given the narrative that has connected stimulus to inflation.
Yeah.
So lots of, you know, lots of fear because of the gas price scare that we've just been through about providing fiscal stimulus. That said, I think you're spot on that there is always a pain threshold. You know, the calls to Congress come in from both the left and the right saying you need to do something, and then that's when they act. And here I would just say to you and your audience, you know, that's a great lagging indicator. When Congress acts in the kind of scale that we saw in 2020 and we saw in 2009, that's basically the lagging indicator that you need that the worst of it's behind us.
Right. That's time to go the other direction. That's your bullish buy signal, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Fascinating. And yeah, I'm curious, and now I'm just asking you to opine, you know, very generally, but like, did the 2020 COVID rescue, did that move the goalposts? Like, in other words, like, are we more likely to intervene sooner on the fiscal side now because we've done it and the world didn't end? Right. In other words, like, I don't think we would have taken such big steps if we hadn't had done as much fiscal stimulus, as much stimulus as we had done in 08. Right.
So I would say had the Democrats lost badly in the midterm elections, and the message from voters was, look at what you did to inflation, then I would say that the odds of extreme fiscal policy would have been down dramatically. But the fact that Democrats did okay, did much better than expected, the fact that we've set expectations with the consumer that Washington will step in if need be, I do think that there is a change in attitude. And so, you know, the fact that we've done it before could be a rallying cry, you know, a populist rallying cry to demand that it be done again.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. So I mentioned that to say, even if, you know, your statement is the more probable one, Peter, which is that probably nothing's going to happen before the 2024 elections, just given both sides going after each other's throats. We have to keep the possibility open that if things got bad enough, they would reverse.
Governments are in the business of responding to public sentiment.
Yeah.
And I say that not as a criticism, just as that's what I observe over and over and over.
Yeah. Well, what I'm really enjoying is through this conversation, I just keep seeing more and more of the dots connected on the sentiment side of things, which I believe is, these are the goggles that you just wear all the time. And it's actually a really useful way to look at the world. All right. So I now do want to get into the wealth gap side of things and the K-shape recovery. Maybe I'll let you define the K-shape recovery for the very few people that haven't already heard about it in the regular media. But just to set the stage really quickly, I could have had a really impassioned discussion with you back in 2019 about the exacerbating wealth divide and the pernicious impact that I think that has on society. And then, of course, the pandemic just came along and poured gasoline all over that fire, right? So I want to get to the question of sort of like, you know, just how toxic you think what is happening here is for society. And maybe I'll just get to my final question. I'll let you get to the answer any way you like, is what's more likely in terms of addressing it? Reform or like revolt? Like we hit just a social breaking point where the dispossessed masses just finally at some point wake up and say, we're not taking it anymore.
Yeah. So K-shaped recovery real quick is the reality that coming out of recessions, those at the top rebound more quickly than those at the bottom. That was absolutely the case in 2009, given the stimulus that went into saving the financial markets, even more so during the pandemic. And so I think what we've seen is sort of K upon K upon K. And that has resulted in this not just divide, a chasm between the haves and have-nots. And I think we have to throw into the conversation that the enormous driver of that divide has its roots in the late 1970s with the concept of maximizing shareholder value. That culturally, societally, those in influence decided that the shareholder had rights and benefits that preempted those of workers, of states, sometimes countries, the environment, choose the subordinate groups. And the result is that if you have been an owner of financial assets, of, you know, particularly equities, you have had the best 40 years known to man. And you have, in many cases, responded by investing blindly, investing in index funds. You know, the passive movement to me is a perfect complement to an environment that gives preference to the shareholder. So no matter where you invest, you're likely to succeed. And so I look at that and say, the shareholder is due his comeuppance in terms of this divide between invulnerability and hopelessness. Mm-hmm. And so I look at the concentration of wealth and the invulnerability that those at the top feel as being highly vulnerable to social outrage. And I don't pretend to know how that social outrage manifests. And it's not a political left versus right. I think that all of the attention left versus right is missing the bigger point. It's up down where the big problem is. And there are far more at the bottom these days than there are at the top. And so I think those who are, you know, have sort of created this financial armor around themselves need to recognize that they are incredibly beholden to a system of workers today like never before. And so I expect that the shareholder is likely to become a bit of a societal pinata. And you know, if the economy were to worsen, you look at the rewards that have been reaped among shareholders that didn't extend down, folks are going to come looking for that.
So I agree. Like when I play this out in my mind, I completely agree. And, you know, there are certain things that I rail about, like buybacks and, you know, the impact that they have. And as you, I'm sure, you know, they used to be illegal and I'm pretty confident they will be again. And I'll understand the reasons why, to be honest. And sadly, while that's been a big impact on share prices and therefore the wealth of those who own the majority of financial assets, which is the top 10%, it's a relatively maybe mild example. And so, you know, I this is just data point of one, right? But like I look at politically, I look at the rise of the appeal of you know, what's called democratic socialism right now. And I'm not going to say all the appeal, but I think part of the appeal of that, especially with younger generations, is they're already looking into this future and feeling like they're already, you know, the game's already lost in their case, right? I just recently interviewed Nicholas Eberstadt, who wrote the book Men Without Work, and we had a really fascinating and really depressing romp through the stats on the modern labor force, or more specifically, the people who aren't even counted in the labor force, the 100 million people that aren't counted in the labor force. And yes, a good chunk of them are too old to work or too young to work or whatever, but because they're still students, and some are homemakers and stay-at-home parents and stuff like that, military. But there is a very large and very fast-growing number of people, and this is in the millions, the tens of millions, that are just opting out. They're just giving up. And what they are doing with their time is not constructive, not to them as individuals, and certainly not to society, right? And that's not a sustainable situation either. And so I just see, you know, that dejection, and I can understand the siren song of more socialist type policies, because I think they're saying, look, yeah, you tell me socialism is bad, but capitalism, at least the kind we have right now, isn't really working for me either. And I might as well vote for the guy who's going to give me some free stuff while I'm getting screwed, right? And I don't want to make this a left-right debate, but I can just see how this is going to impact the political landscape going forward. And that's, you and I know, those policies aren't sustainable either. And so, I again, data point of one, but I have a hard time seeing us avoiding a point in the future where enough of a large number of people, the pain of the status quo gets so great where they just say, look, I just can't accept this anymore, because I literally can't put food on the table. I can't feed my family. And I'm going to have to rise up in some way, shape, or form. And hopefully that takes a political outlet, but it might not, right?
Yeah.
So, anyways, you're nodding, so I'm saying a lot of this, but I'm curious, like, how much of a worry for you is this?
It's a real worry, because I think your point is right, that there's a sense of hopelessness, that the divide can be closed. And, you know, I've got two, 20-something children who are looking at the cost of housing, you know, and that entry-level house is unaffordable. And so these are questions that, there's a view, and this is going to get into ageism as well, where you older people have done really well at the expense of we younger people.
Yeah. Okay, boomer.
Yeah. You know, why are we paying your pension? Why are we, you know, so these are the issues that flow into the stories. And I agree with you that it quickly moves into a less left versus right. And I really think that that's missing the point, because you could see a right oriented leader who is anti-capitalist at the same time. And so I think the rhetoric against big corporations that we're seeing from both the left and the right, we need to recognize resonates. And so I think the power, the wealth that is so concentrated in so few becomes a very easy, as I said, pinata for those seeking public office.
Yeah, especially when you look at the average wealth of our, you know, electorate in Congress. I don't know the stats off the top of my head, but they're all millionaires, basically.
I mean, the fact that there is a term called hillionaire ought to be something that people take note of. I mean, the insider trading and the wealth that is concentrated in Washington is substantial, and so it feeds into the conspiracy theories and the narratives that the system is rigged against those who are at the bottom.
Yeah, and just to beat this horse bloody, it is so optically bad, the insider trading that is still allowed by people in Congress, right? And it came to a forefront about a year ago or something like that, right? When Senator Pelosi's trades, as well as a bunch of others, and of course all the Federal Reserve, you know, leaders that were front running Fed policy too, and I think that all died out. Like I'm pretty sure, I could be misremembering, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think, while there were some promises to get to the bottom of this and stuff, like I don't think any actual changes were still yet made, and it's just so optically toxic to trust in the system. Anyways, I don't want us to side rail on that, but because confidence is such a big part of what you look through. I just feel like the vast majority of your public loses confidence in the fairness of the system and their ability to participate in the promise of the system, things can go sideways. The odds of them going sideways get real high.
They do, particularly when confidence falls. And there, I think we need to just, pay very, very close attention to consumer sentiment, because institutions become highly vulnerable. And we see this over and over as sentiment falls. And, why do things ebb and flow? They ebb and flow because our mood changes. And so if confidence were to take a major step down again, you'll see highly emotional, highly impulsive behavior. And one of the things that I emphasize a lot is, we look at these major sentiment indicators. And those to me are how America woke up this morning. But you then need to think about, well, what are the groups that are already negatively impacted on top of that? And there, all you need is a triggering event. And so it doesn't have to be a major thing that creates this wildfire. And we've seen this now in Iran with the young woman and it doesn't take much. When people feel hopeless and worse, unheard, then all bets are off.
All right. Well, and that's one of the things that worries me here is I have a hard time coming up with the next great bullish sentiment driver for the American populace. So right now, one of the questions I still have for you is, what are some of the indicators you look at? I'm assuming the University of Michigan Consumer Confidence Index is one of them, which I think is still down near its lows. It's probably off the lows, but it got real low, like almost in the history of the data series low recently, right?
Yeah, I mean, some of the indicators that I look at are a function of who I'm looking at. If I want to look at middle-class America, I'm going to look at Carnival Cruise Lines.
Okay.
That to me is one of the best real-time sentiment indicators of how are, how's maybe not Main Street, but how's those with a little bit feeling. It's not a pretty picture.
Yeah. Well, and obviously COVID kind of put a stake in the heart of the appeal of cruise lines, but still I know people have been coming back a bit. But where I'm going with this is that indicator, it sounds like, and certainly the more general University of Michigan confidence indicator, they're low, right? People are not confident right now. And yet, going back to the employment picture, we're at 3.7% unemployment, right? At least as they measure it in this country, right? So my point is I don't see how people are going to feel a hell of a lot more flush going forward, because we already have, so they still tell us, more job openings than we have workers to apply for them. Who knows what's going to happen with the markets, but the reality is that, the vast majority of financial assets are owned by the top folks. So what happens in the Wall Street, in the stock market on any given day, doesn't impact the average person all that much, right? And if you look at housing, Jesus Christ, I don't know what's going to save housing, for the next couple of years. That seems like it's going to be rolling over for a whole variety of things, even if the Fed pivots real hard next year. So, I just really have a hard time saying, what is going to drive, what could happen that would make a huge swath of Americans feel like, I feel much better than I did this year.
Yeah. And I think, Adam, one of the points that you just raised is, we have near record employment in terms of percentages and people don't feel good. And to me, that's a real statement on job satisfaction and capitalism. And I don't think we should diminish the vulnerability that corporations face when jobs don't satisfy people, make them feel confident. Employees feel that they're, in bad times they lose their job, in good times they make 2 or 3% increases. That there's the sense of certainty and the sense of control workers feel today is especially low. And so that has to change in the workplace, because if it doesn't change, there's no one who's going to advocate for the corporation when things turn down. And I think the corporation's greatest threat today is that there is no one to advocate for capitalism.
Okay. And if I can add some color for you to react to, a lot of people, I include myself amongst them, who would say the flavor of capitalism we have today is not the great capitalism that we like to imagine this country has, that it once had. It's much more of a captured capitalist, crony, almost kind of cartel run type of capitalism in many areas. And I think that that's why people are losing confidence in it, because they see that, right? To your point, hey, company gets in bad times, it's going to drop me like a hot potato. In good times, I might get a measly raise. Meanwhile, the CEO is walking out with, you know, $100 million a year, right?
Yeah, I mean, I watched, you know, in the last couple of weeks, corporations laying people off at the same time the executive suite is asking the board to hold them harmless from, you know, the various factors of the year. And it's like, yeah, you know, guys, that just really smells. And I think that your point is a good one. You know, whether you call it postmodern capitalism, I mean, there are all sorts of terms for it. The problem with it is that nuance is going to get lost. The capitalism, when workers decide they've had enough, they're not going to say, we don't like this style of capitalism, we prefer that style. They're just going to say, no, you know, what exists today is broken for me.
Capitalism is bad. Let's find something.
Capitalism
else.
And is bad.
I agree. That is the real risk here, right? Is that the baby is thrown out with the bathwater, that we don't look below the surface to say something great was corrupted. Let's get back to what we had. It's going to be, let's just get rid of it.
Right? Yeah. And that's the nature of our low confidence response. You know, smoke, I smell smoke, run. I'm not going to stop to say, you know, what's burning? You know, how big is the flame? No, I'm, you know, so the impulsive overreaction, I think, is very threatening to capitalism, unfortunately.
Okay. So I feel like I took this conversation in a direction that was a little gloomy. I think everything you and I talked about is real, and it's important that we all look at this with clear eyes. And kind of wrapping up here, and feel free to mention anything else you haven't said that you think is important, Peter, but I want to give you a chance that, like, what are some stories, some narratives that you would like to see us leaning into more as a society if we want to have the type of better tomorrow that we'd all like?
I think we should be, we need to be suspicious and be careful not to be underconfident. So we readily accept this notion that we can be overconfident. Always tends to be proven in fact after the fact, but we easily accept that, yeah, I was overconfident when that happened. I was overconfident when this happened. I think that we societally are at a real risk of being underconfident, that the doom saying is so easily accepted that we lose sight of the fact that this is typically the ash from which things rise back up. And I'm not saying that, you know, the bottom is in, or the, you know, maybe the bottom is in, but I think we have to be really careful. And there are a couple of reasons for that. There are five responses we have to low confidence. Fight and flight are familiar to everybody. Another one is freeze. The other two are important. One is follow. And there I would say we're not good judges when we don't have confidence in being careful about who we follow. We'll follow anybody. You know, if we're standing in the rain, we'll hop in the car with anybody. And that's a real shortcoming. And we need to be careful about those people, particularly today, who come out and present themselves with sort of this messianic, you know, I know all the answers, you know, you need to believe in me, follow me. But the other one, and this is the one that I worry about the most, is our fuck it response. You know, fight, flight, freeze, follow, and fuck it. And so the danger is that people just say, I'm out in mass. And so we need to be mindful of the fact that we can create our own stories of gloom and doom. And we need to recognize that those stories are merely a reflection of how we feel, much more than they are an actual valuable forecast of what's ahead.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And you're making me feel like I need to say this, which I've said before, but is, you know, on Wealthion, we talk a lot about, you know, serious issues. And we, I would say, you know, spend a lot of time talking with a fair amount of short-term pessimism. And I think that that's, I'll make it clear, that's because of sort of the way the cards are currently laid out on the table. It is not a philosophy, right? And as I've said many times, I can't wait on this program to be interviewing people about the phenomenal opportunities that are opening up for investors once we get through some of the process that we likely probabilistically, you know, may need to crunch through before those opportunities arise. But I agree with you, Peter. And, you know, that's part of what's made America so great, right? Is we dream big, right? You know, the whole promise of America is anybody can come here and they can really, you know, reach for the stars. And if you fail, you know, the cost of failure is the bruises, and you get up, you dust yourself off, and you try again, now smarter, right? So your odds for success maybe even go up a little bit on the second try, right? And so that's been a big part of who we've been culturally, that's led us to produce so many of the world's great innovators. But I also think it's true, which is that, you know, that the cost of failure used to not be as high as I think the perception is now. And there's probably a whole bunch of factors for that, both the way the system runs and probably social media, where you're now relatively judging yourself against everybody's perfect top success, right? But as I talked about, you know, my conversation with Nicholas Everstadt, is we are seeing that fuck it response in a dangerously high number of people and growing at this point. So we've got to do something about this relatively quickly, because the more people that fall into that gap, it's like water filling into a boat. Eventually, it just capsizes the whole thing. So it's a real danger. And so, you know, we need to, you know, be building these better narratives or more optimistic narratives to give people a chance to wrap that around themselves. But of course, that's going to have to come with real opportunities for those people to apply themselves with, because right now a lot of people just feel like there's not a place for them, and that is really toxic.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, we lament all the problems that exist today, and we don't look at those problems as opportunities. Those problems need to be fixed. So how do you fix them in a way that hire, you know, employs people, you know, builds a community? There are lots of opportunities in all of the problems that we identify. And totally those become real valuable businesses and valuable parts of communities and society.
Well, exactly. And we'll have to delve into this next time you come on the program, Peter. But, you know, I look at those millions and millions of people, you know, ages 25 to 54, who are healthy, right, and have been through the schooling system, many of them. And I just look at that as untapped human capital, right? And imagine what we could do if we could apply that. And imagine for many of these people, how much enriching that would be for them, not just financially, but just in terms of their own sense of self-worth and, you know, self-esteem and their daily quality of life and all that stuff. So it is a massive opportunity, but we got to find a way to tap into it. All right. I didn't mean to go so much off on the, you know, existential side of things here, but I appreciate you going there with me. Well, Peter, for folks that have really enjoyed this conversation and looking through the world through your confidence framework, where can they go to learn more about you and follow you?
So they can follow me on Twitter. I'm Peter_Atwater on Twitter. They can follow me on LinkedIn. They can also reach out to me through my website, either peteratwater.com or financialinsights, spelled with a Y, .com. I track confidence every day and write a lot about different opportunities that I see and in behavior and how to not fall victim to a lot of the overhyped stories that seem to dominate social media.
All right. Well, fantastic, Peter. Really appreciate it. Folks, if you have enjoyed this time here with Peter as much as I have and would like to see them both come back in the program and let us also attract other big thinkers like him, please do me a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button and clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And if you are thinking about some of the potential market arcs where asset prices could go, if Peter is correct in terms of where he thinks how the markets may play out next year, these are very tricky times for an individual investor to navigate on their own. So I just want to reiterate our message that we always deliver on this channel. Highly recommend that you work under the guidance of a professional financial advisor who takes these issues, probabilities, and these confidence indicators into account when creating a portfolio strategy and then helping you manage it. If you've got a good one who already does that, great, stick with them. They are incredibly valuable. But if you don't, consider talking to one of the ones that Wealthion endorses, even if you just want a second opinion. To do that, just go to wealthion.com, fill out the short form there. It doesn't cost you anything. There's no commitment to work with those guys. It's just a public service. Peter, this has been a fantastic discussion. Thank you so much for giving us so much of your time today.
I appreciate it, Adam. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And everybody else, thanks so much for watching. We'll be right back.